Connect the dots with Allison Rose Levy, Saturdays at noon, Eastern, on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots, and I'm Allison Rose Levy. I'm here every Saturday at noon Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network to bring you shows that make the connection between our personal health, our society, culture, and world global environment. We connect the dots in all different ways so that we can make sense of what's going on in our world, the stories that are coming to us or not coming to us via the media, and also take action on important, things like this weekend's tar sand event that really help us to shift the world and move things in a positive direction. I'm very, very excited about the guest on today's show. It's Ricky Ott, PhD, and she is a marine toxicologist. She's a community activist. And she has been following and working with the Gulf oil spill that happened a few years back and has kind of faded from the headlines, but not from our world, sadly. That continues to evolve, despite the lack of coverage and lack of understanding of what's really going on there. And she's been down there on the scene and in constant touch with the community of affected people, and, as a toxicologist, as a biologist, to really track what's going on with that. And the story that she has to tell has a tremendous amount of resonance with every environmental story on every front that we're now facing. She's also the author of a terrific book called Not One Drop, Betrayal and Courage in the Wake of the Exxon Valdez Occurrence. This is a Chelsea Green publication that's just a few years old and is preparing an upcoming book. Her other book is called Sound Truth, and she has a whole variety of important actions up ahead that we'll continue to cover in both this show, blogs, and my e-zine that are really important for preserving, protecting, repairing planetary health. So welcome, Ricky. So delighted to have you here.
Thank you, Allison, for this opportunity.
So actually, I'm going to share with our listeners that we connected at the Connecting for Change Pioneers East Conference a few weeks back, and we're supposed to talk for, I think they said we had 20 minutes or something, and we ended up speaking for several hours because your story is just so rich and there's so much to tell. So first off, you were already an activist and had been on the case and following the Exxon Valdez incident before the Gulf oil spill. Can you tell us just a little bit, fill in our listeners a little bit about Exxon Valdez and why that's kind of like the historical background and lesson for what's going on in the Gulf today?
Well, actually, I want to go just even a little step further back than that, because I didn't consider myself an activist. And I think that this is kind of like an important point for listeners, a lot of listeners who are like, home and going, okay, what can I do? And when I was a child growing up in Wisconsin, back in the late 1960s, birds were literally falling out of trees dying, robins. So here I am, a little middle school student walking to school, and these birds are augering in at my feet, falling out of trees, and I'm like, what the heck is going on? And so I went home from school one day, and I asked my father. My father was a paper salesman, very engaged in civic, life, and I didn't see him as any great scientist or anything. He's just an ordinary dad, and he put a dying robin in my hand and explained to me about the neurotoxin DDT, and it worried him. It worried him because it was knocking robins out of trees, and his three kids, us, were supposed to be walking to school in this stuff, and he sued the state of Wisconsin over the use of DDT, and I thought this it was normal because it was in growing up to me, and I thought, oh, I get it. When something is wrong in the world, if if you understand why, my dad had read Rachel Carson's Silent Spring as well, you know, you step up and you do something about it. So I just was kind of following this, and my dad won. I thought, cool, you know, and then the rest of the nation followed suit when I went off to become a marine biologist, because by then I had read all of Rachel Carson's books, and I just thought that that was something I'd be interested in doing. So for me, the lesson, you know, kind of fast forward now through 13 years of higher so-called education, master's, doctorate, everything, and I was at the University of Washington finally with my getting my doctorate, and I thought, well, I'm just going to take one summer off. I'm going to go up to Alaska. And as a marine biologist, I found a job, commercial fishing. I totally loved it. And I decided, this is it. I'm going to stay in Alaska. And so I kind of went from, you know, my dad, as he tells the story, my daughter, the scientist, to my daughter, the commercial fisherwoman. But 4 years after I moved to Alaska, sort of unintentionally, you know, 1985, there was the Exxon Valdez oil spill in now my backyard, Prince William Sound. And I remember the teaching of my dad, and it was clearly my turn now to step up. And I never saw it as being an activist. I saw it as sort of homeland, you know, defense here. I knew enough to make a difference. That's what occurred to me. I know enough to make a difference. Now what am I going to do? And I just started working with the fishermen and applying the science that I knew. And then a very sort of long, strange journey emerged in which I had not learned at school how the politics can twist and warp the science so that it will be unrecognizable to what I was taught in school. And that same politics and the money, the corporate money, can literally twist the legal system. That was all new to me. And I kind of made a commitment in 1989, flying over the wreck of the Exxon Valdez, and just sort of being heartbroken by this big mess. And I thought, I'm going to work upstream of these oil spills, because as long as we drill, we will spill. So I'm going to work upstream to help our nation transition off of fossil fuels. And that, it turns out it's less science than I thought, because the science has pretty much been captured. And after, so Exxon Valdez, what happened was, in a nutshell, that 4 years after the Exxon Valdez oil spill, our ecosystem completely collapsed.
In Alaska.
And in hindsight, of 10 years of scientific studies that were comprehensive, looked at ecosystem connections, wildlife to their habitat, relationships between generations, relationships, food web. It was pretty much concluded that the oil that was buried on the beaches and still is there to a large part is what's called polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. It's the heavy stuff. It's the black stuff. It's the sludge. It's not the stuff like at the gas station where if you stand there while you're filling your car, you get that kind of sweet smell. Those are volatile organic carbons. That's what had been studied prior to the Exxon Valdez. That was what was studied as the basis for the Clean Water Act and Clean Air Act. And here comes this heavier stuff sort of out of the blue that the scientists really haven't studied that much. And it turns out 10 years of studies, Exxon Valdez now show that these PAHs are very bad actors, and they jam cell function. So reproductive hormones, respiratory enzymes, DNA coding, suppressed immune system function, a stunt growth of juvenile fish and birds. And it turns out that the medical community was advancing during these same sort of 10 years that the wildlife biologists were doing this intense study. And it was kind of going on a parallel course with the medical community, where now, we're 22 years after Exxon Valdez now almost, it's a pretty clear understanding that oil does cause health impacts to both people and ecosystems. So that's sort of the biological impact. And then there was a whole other layer of mental trauma that we had not anticipated in Cordova, where because we couldn't work, our fisheries were closed down. The herring fishery is still closed 22 almost years later. Where were we going to get income? I mean, we're a fishing town. And so that kind of tore the community apart, and the way that sort of fear and uncertainty manifested in our community was, you know, spikes in substance abuse, domestic violence, suicides, divorces. I mean, it got bad. And we had a problem.
I'm just going to interject here for a second, because the show's listeners and Connected Us, we talk a lot about health. And, you know, and in fact, we've covered, had certain speakers on who talk about mind-body medicine and everything. So I just want to highlight that what you're talking about there is both the physiological impacts, which are quite severe. The ones you mentioned are all quite severe. And what starts there, if you're interfering with cell function in the way that you're describing on a biological level, it doesn't end there. It's not like it came and it went, it stopped it for a day. You know, you stop that kind of activity, and it has ongoing, progressive, and worsening effects on a physical level. At the same time, the kind of mental health things that you're describing there are just, on the one hand, when you talk about job loss, I mean, that's a real shift in people's lives, and also it's just a shock to a whole community and system, which really, in effect, is what post-traumatic stress disorder is. It's something that people can't integrate, and that also has both psychological effects as well as neurological effects.
Oops, thought you were done. Never mind. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, it's fine. Yeah. You know, so you get both things together,
on
like a double whammy, you know.
Exactly. And so 2 points take off on what you said is that we have a lot of remote, very isolated beaches. It's not like the Gulf of Mexico, which we're going to get to in a second. But so mostly what we had were sick workers, frontline beach response, spill responders, what so-called cleanup workers. But I don't like calling them cleanup because they left a big mess behind. You know, we really can't clean these things up. So those workers are still sick to this day. When I thought to do a health survey back 14 years after the Exxon Valdez, I had workers say to me, oh my gosh, you know, I thought I had the Valdez crud. That's what Exxon called these cold and flu-like symptoms, headaches, dizziness, nausea, all very ordinary symptoms, but really it wasn't an ordinary illness. It was chemical illness. Exxon got away calling it the Valdez crud. Everybody had it, so they sort of normalized the abnormal. When they went home in the fall, they thought they would get better, and that's where the real trouble began, because as you just said, these toxic chemicals, they lodge in your body. They embed, especially the oils. The oils embed in, like, the stable fat of your body. So, like, the kidney pads, the lining, the sheath of the intestine, it wreaks havoc over time. It can trigger diseases that you've carried but that haven't really manifested yet. It can basically wreck your life. We're talking respiratory problems, chemical sensitivities, neurological impairment, exactly what it says on the material safety data sheets. Skin conditions, respiratory conditions, and neurological conditions. There it all was. Central nervous system.
That's very serious stuff. And not to spoil the punchline here, be a spoiler on the plot as it evolves, but just alerting listeners to pay attention. What happened there with oil problems in Alaska, we have a whole bunch of other oil and gas and fossil fuel related energy retrieval methods that are not contained and that do exude forth in a whole variety of different ways into the health environment of people. And, you know, so we've talked about gas drilling, fracking a lot on this show. We're going to be talking further about your experience in the Gulf. We now have the tar sands. So, you know, this is all of the unpleasant conditions, the really horrible things that you're discussing, this is not just oh, it kind of happened up there in Alaska X number of years ago and poor Zen. This is something that, sad to say, could be coming to a neighborhood near you in many, many different parts of the country, or may already have done so, just wanting to highlight that.
Well, and thank you for pointing that out, because the only reason I'm watching the clock, I know how fast an hour can go by. The only reason I was actually spending a little bit of time on Exxon Valdez is because this is repeating all over the country. And I am in Battle Creek, Michigan right now. I just came off a meeting with the residents here who are sick from the Enbridge pipeline spill in August 2010, and I'm going to circle back to this. This is the very first tar sands spill in the United States with horrific results. I'm talking grand mal seizures in these neighborhoods and people dying. But let's come back to this, because I really want to set the stage a little bit more. Exxon Valdez was really a pivotal study in a number of ways. There was a paradigm shift in the understanding of oil impacts to marine ecosystems. That was published in Science magazine back in 2003, based on the long-term comprehensive studies that were done in Prince William Sound. Similarly, there was also a case study on Cordova, my little tiny fishing town where I was, that became a case study in disaster trauma. That is still to this day the longest running case study in disaster trauma, man-made disaster trauma. It happened, Exxon Valdez happened at a time when the sociologists were just kind of scratching their heads going, wait a second, all these natural disasters that we've just been calling a disaster, it turns out the models to mitigate this trauma and harm and get these communities back up on their feet again that we have developed for floods, fires, earthquakes, gee, these models don't seem to be working so well for man-made disasters. Is there a difference in trauma between man-made and natural disasters? And based on Exxon Valdez, Dr. Steve P. Koo, who is still a professor at the University of South Alabama down near Orange Beach, he came up to study us with Duane Gill, University of Mississippi, and I'm just trying to make sure I got Duane Gill. I think that's right.
Okay, he came to study you up at Exxon then.
Up in Alaska, and literally studied the two population sectors of the population that were most impacted by this, which of course were the fishermen and the native people, the Alaska native people, because we depend on a healthy natural environment for either our economic basis or the basis of our culture as native people. And either way, it's very deeply embedded in who we are. When you take that away, bad things happen to both of these sections, you know, both of these. So that study, unfortunately, the one paradigm shift we were missing was that oil causes long-term harm to people. This evolved in workers, occupational medicine, which is different than general public. Mm-hmm. Well, so what this didn't evolve in Alaska with Exxon Valdez, but it did evolve in the general, what we call the lower 48. A new field of medicine emerged during the same time that this Exxon Valdez, you know, studies were going on, and that new field is called occupational and environmental medicine. I think environmental medicine is a very misleading phrase, because the environment is not poisonous. It's the chemicals that are in the environment. Mm-hmm. So really, we're not talking environmental illness, we're talking chemical illness.
I think that's a really important distinction, because when Dr. Sanjay Gupta was examining the Toxic Chemical Safety Act at that time up for a vote in Congress and had devoted a half-hour program to that, talking about the 80,000 unstudied, unregulated, and possibly unsafe chemicals that are just put out for use and therefore people are exposed to them. He had a denier on the program from one of these, you know, well-paid institutes funded by chemical companies behind the scenes, but, you know, it had a name that would lead one to think that, you know, they were objective in some regard. And this woman came out and she said, why worry about the synthetic chemicals that we produce when there are so many harmful chemicals in nature, you know? And so, you know, and this is, a wonderful example of how people, you know, basically create misinformation. So I think, you know, like, because if there's, you know, some kind of a natural poison in nature, that doesn't mean that you're running out to eat it or drink it or inhale it or would come into contact with it unless you did something extremely unusual. So I think it's really, I like your differentiation. I think it's really, I mean, perhaps they should even be called, perhaps it's not even occupational though, Ricky. Perhaps it's just saying industrial. Because, you know, people who don't have the job of dealing with something can also become exposed to it, as you're pointing out, you know.
And that was the point of calling it OEM doctors, as they're now called, occupational and environmental medicine, because mm-hmm. it turns out these chemicals have been unleashed onto an unwitting public, and mm-hmm. we are assuming that they're safe because we have all these agencies that are supposed to protect us in the federal government, and it turns out that is just simply not what's happening at all. These chemicals are being unleashed with very little testing and with the onus, the burden of proof being on the public to come and say, oh, well, I'm sick, you know, prove it's from this chemical. As opposed to using, say, what Europe is starting to do, the precautionary approach, which flips the burden of proof around. And, you know, if it looks like it's going to be a problem, then the industry that wants to release this chemical and market it has to prove that it's not a problem. And it's very hard to prove conclusively that a chemical causes harm. It's much easier to say it looks like it could be a problem. There's indications. There's enough weight of evidence that using the precautionary principle, we're going to ban this chemical. And that is, in fact, what the European Union has done with a lot of these 80,000 chemicals that you just mentioned. Said, to the point where there's a very good book. I don't know if you had it. This is a total distraction, the detour route, but that's okay. A very good book called Exposed by Mark Shapiro that is very well-told story. I like well-told stories. I like science where it can be boiled down and made understandable to the public, and I think that's mm-hmm. in storytelling form. But anyway, this book, Mark's an investigative journalist with the San Francisco Chronicle, and he covered the story of the European Union coming to wrestle with all these toxic chemicals in our environment, just like what you said. And the European Union was besieged by our corporations, our big corporations that manufacture cosmetics and products for cars and computers and toys. And the European Union pretty much said 550 million strong consumers from a corporate perspective, said, you know what, we don't have this whole lobby thing like what you do in the United States. We get to make up our own minds over here, and these toxic chemicals are banned. Mark then followed the same lobbyists across the Atlantic to California, where California was trying to say, well, if the European Union's going to do this, you know, California leads a lot of our more progressive laws in terms of worker health, public safety, and the environmental protection. California said, well, we're going to try to ban these same toxic chemicals. The corporate lobby comes down and, oh, whoa, you'll throw us out of business. And basically the U.S. fell for it. So, for example, China, which makes 85% of the toys in the world, now makes a stream of toys, no kidding, without toxic chemicals, without, for a Europe, and with toxic chemicals for America.
Wow!
Thank you very much. Yeah.
Wow. So we're going to have
crazy.
To come. We're going to have to come up with a break on a break here, Ricky, and we'll return after that. But that's really quite a punchline there. So it's kind of like, along with our American citizenship, we've made a decision to allow that we would prefer to have our products. You know, with toxic chemicals. Hey, does everyone remember voting for that one? I don't. But in any case, We will take a break now, and we will be back to continue this wonderful conversation with Ricky Ott after some station identification. Stay with us. Welcome back, listeners, to the second portion of Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy. I write for the Huffington Post, and also my website is healthjournalist.com, where you can sign up for a weekly e-zine that I send out, and it announces upcoming radio programs like this one, includes my featured Huffington blogs, and also directs you toward important health and environmental actions that you can participate in to make a shift and make a healthier society and healthier world for ourselves. My guest on today's show is Ricky Ott. She is a marine biologist who has really tracked a very important series of happenings from the Exxon Valdez incident, which we were discussing in the first part of the show, to her next major work, which was tracking the immediate after effects of the Gulf oil spill that took place a few years back, and as she indicated in an earlier part of the show, she's also venturing on from there to some contamination from Perth tar sands pipeline work that she's been looking at where she is now visiting, as she calls into the program. So, Ricky, I just wanted to fast forward to the Gulf because for our remaining half hour, and clearly we're going to have you on again, just to kind of connect that dot for our listeners. So tell us about that portion of your work, please.
Okay, there's one more segue that we're going to need from Alaska, mm-hmm. which is as we got into our 2-decade-long lawsuit with Exxon to prove that our claims were reasonable, that we really needed to be compensated for these long-term losses, people began to ask, how did corporations get this big, that they can manipulate the entire legal system? You know, how did this happen, that they can manipulate our government? Because we all saw it as a community. And I didn't know. I went to research that. And I discovered, much to my horror, that while I was off pursuing science, I really didn't pay that much attention to history, to civics, so this is kind of another note to any young adult listeners, that our democracy literally was hijacked by corporations back in 1886. Through the Supreme Court, through a lawsuit, that the Supreme Court basically conferred a railroad corporation to the 14th Amendment rights, which meant the rights for equal protection under the law. Ever since 1886, the corporations have been now using these rights. This human protection that they got, equal protection under the law, made them a person equal to us. Yes, they are an artificial person. They don't need clean air, clean water, anything like that. But not to human persons, equal under the law. So the corporations have been quite successful at getting more and more of our rights. The Fifth Amendment, take compensation for takings is one aspect of it. The Fourth Amendment, protection against search and seizure, unreasonable search and seizure. And what that looks like in our legal system is that any law that protects worker safety, public health, or the environment, the corporations are construing as a taking of their future profit. Because, for example, respirators for workers cost money. Long-term health care for workers cost money. Scrubbers for our incinerators for air cost money. If they can dodge those requirements, then they have made a bigger profit. So what happened was I learned all this from Alaska, and have literally launched in America. I'm trying to see if the American people are ready for an amendment to the U.S. Constitution to say that corporations are not persons. That's kind of where all of our woes stem from. And I'm literally on tour when I hear about the Gulf disaster, and I first spent a week saying, no, I can't do that again. That was in April 2010. I've been through this once. I can't do it again. And then I started remembering how much we as a community learned and how many mistakes we made and how many mistakes people in the Gulf were going to make unless somebody went down and coached them into what to believe and what not to believe. And I went, oh, my gosh. And I booked a one-way ticket before I lost my nerve and basically wound up in the Gulf. And within 2 days, I was down in the community of Venice and connected with the fisher men down there and the fisherwomen, the fishing community, because those were all the first responders. And literally that was May 5th. The people, I called a spontaneous meeting with the Louisiana Shrimp Association, and the people who came to the meeting were already reporting that their husbands, their sons, who were out at working on the in-situ burn team, remember the first response was to corral this with fire boom and literally torch it, and also to use dispersants in planes and at the source a mile down, release these toxic chemicals into the environment. People were already reporting headaches, dizziness, nausea, sore throats, trouble breathing. And I just opened my first book on the Exxon Valdez, and I read those exact same symptoms back to people. And people literally started crying, and it was like, oh, my God. And they accepted me as a commercial fisherman, which was it was helpful to me because I needed to be networked across the Gulf. And I think being a scientist sometimes is a scary thing, and people put you up on a pedestal, and really this made me very human, very real, and accepted. And I stayed in people's homes across the Gulf. I mean, I literally rented a car long-term and just went across the Gulf, back and forth, and sharing stories. Really, people in Mobile, Alabama, you're telling me you're sick and you have these skin rashes and these headaches and ear bleeds. Guess what? I'm hearing the same stories in South Louisiana. I'm hearing the same stories in Mississippi. I'm hearing the same stories coming out of Florida. And I literally stitched the Gulf stories together by going back and forth across the Gulf. And then weaving my stories of Alaska into this. This already happened to us. We know from Alaska that it was oil. But EPA is telling us, the people would say, that the air is safe to breathe. How could they say that when it gives me a headache and it closes my throat down? How could EPA be saying that to us? I said, the government lies. It lies to us. In Alaska, we know that it lies. What's your plan B if you think the government might not be telling the truth to you? This is a very hard thing for people to hear, because you want to believe that the government is there to protect you against this big corporation. You're the one who's hurt. Why would the government be protecting a corporation? But here, I'd already been through this once. And I could say, what's your plan B? And people would say, what can we do? And I would say, what do you want to do? Because another thing that I found in America is that people want to assign somebody else to take care of you. You don't want to have to do that yourself. And especially in the Deep South, people have a very colonized mind down there. They're very polite, and they're very acquiescent to authority. And I had to challenge that. I had to get them to challenge it in their heads in a polite way. What do you want to do? And so people started to think, you know, here's a community of people. They've come to hear me, and I'm turning it right back on them to get them to talk to each other. And they would ask me after a little bit of discussion, can we take our own air samples? Of course you can. And so groups like Louisiana Environmental Action Network, Louisiana Bucket Brigade, we all kind of pitched together and found labs and helped train people with ways that people could take air quality sample. You know, you could take a viable sample that a lab could analyze. Water quality samples were next, you know. Soil beach samples were next. And as I went back and forth across the Gulf, the lab results started to come in. And people were finding that basically they'd been poisoned, you know, that it was in their swimming pools, it was in their beach, on their beach sand, it was in the air. And okay, so now what? The next question came, well, how can I show that I'm sick because of what's in the air and the water? And so that became the volatile organic solvent profile, the blood sampling. So that protocol is still posted to this day on my website.
That's very helpful, yep.
Mm-hmm. And I just started telling the people here in Michigan, in Battle Creek, Michigan, that we need to start figuring out how to get those samples done. So people took those samples of their blood, and they were horrified to find that what was in the Gulf Stream went straight into their bloodstream. And these people tested in the Gulf of Mexico, tested in the upper 95th to 100th percentile of nationwide. In other words, here's a baseline, you know, bell curve, and these people have more oil in their blood than 95 to 100% of anybody else who's tested. And they were horrified.
You know what, I want to ask you something about this, because, you know, what happens is, you know, I just want to draw this out, because I've talked a lot about fracking on the show, and yet a lot of people remain in denial. I mean, people don't understand that what's in, I mean, Deepak Chopra said it at an event recently about fracking in New York City. He said what goes into the water goes into your body. And so people don't really quite get the message, and nor do they get the message that if it's happening in your region and if it's happening in your state, it's extremely likely that it'll be happening to you and not just to somebody else. So, you know, what I hear you recounting here, and one of the reasons that you and I and a lot of other people are beating the drum for, you know, certain of the actions and, you know, and initiatives like the one you mentioned about the amendment and others to help stop the acceleration of climate change through the tar sands or to prevent fracking or all of these various different things. The reason we're doing that, any of us, is that we're doing it for the community. And if it seems like if you don't get the message for the community, that you're part of the community, that what happens, you know, to the community happens to you, if you don't get that message, then you're going to be there with that community taking blood tests and blood samples, because you'll find out a different way. You'll find out once it's in your blood. I hate to be, you know, kind of tough about it, but, you know, one way or another, we're going to get the message that we can't afford to ignore these things. So I think, you know, what you're describing, where people are, like, you know, getting the shock of the fact that it's come to them, it's affecting their health, the government didn't protect them, this isn't just their story, this is all our stories. And so the question that I put to everyone listening to this show is simply this: will you listen sooner and take action, or will you deal with it later when it's going to be harder to deal with because it's going to be affecting your health? And that's my little pitch, and now I'll get back off that platform.
But this is a critical thing, because this was like an unfolding horror show in the Gulf. Mm-hmm. I mean, mm-hmm. Yes, those of us who are scientists and who are educated, yes, we know that what's in our air, and we breathe it, we drink it, we eat it in our food. Of course it gets into our body. And what we're seeing now are children being born with, you know, 200-some chemicals in their body that came in through the umbilical cord, no lifestyle choice of their own to make. And some of these chemicals are at levels that are going to impair their neurological development and their function as a human being in the world. And so for the people in the Gulf, they had just not considered this. It's exactly what you're saying. This ripped open a Pandora's box, because what have we as Americans done, I was ashamed to find in the Gulf, is that this whole stepping back, what we as a rich, developed nation have done is outsourced a lot of our pollution problems and to third world countries, to the so-called developing nations. But the ones that we didn't outsource we put them in the poorer places in America, and that happens to be the South, the Deep South. That happens to be Appalachia. You know, I'm talking Louisiana, Mississippi, part of Alabama.
Upstate New York, I will add to that, where the fracking is slated to occur, is going to be joining that party all too soon unless people take action on November 21st.
Mm-hmm. November 6th is when there's going to be a big circling of hands around the White House on the
right,
tar sand
issue. Right,
the
show is going to actually air after that, but it's going to air before the November 26th march to the Delaware River Basin in Trenton, New Jersey, that's voting to allow gas drilling in the Delaware River, which would affect the water supply of New York City and Philadelphia, and all points south as well. So that's
okay.
What the November 21st date is, yeah.
Okay, so let's loop back to this because here's the story with oil, is that we literally are, those of us on Earth right now, are facing a sort of the twin challenges of peak oil and the climate crisis. And as we hit, and peak oil, there's plenty of oil or fossil fuel substances on the planet. That's not really what we're talking about. Peak oil is really specifically the cheap, easy to access. You poke a pipe in the, and up gushes oil. That stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And because we're running out of that cheap stuff, it is pushing the industry, the fossil fuel industry, into ever riskier places that they haven't gone before because it's more money and it was cheap and easier to do it the other way. Well, now this is how we're getting the offshore oil and the deep water offshore oil. This is why we're having this fracking sweeping across the nation right now. And the tar sands. And these riskier methodologies, the risk is not borne by the industry. It is borne by people, by people's health. It is borne by people in terms of their lifestyles having to completely change around, them having to look at the movie Gaslands, look at the movie Split Estate, look at the new movie that's come out on the Gulf disaster, The Big Fix. This is about government-industry collusion to minimize the damage in public of what the true hidden costs are of our fossil fuel industry, the way it's headed right now. This has got to be stopped. It is literally poisoning aquifers. Our drinking water is the most precious thing we have. It is more precious than oil. Fracking, there are other energy options. We do not have an option right now for clean, free-flowing drinking water. That's it. And for these tar sands, it takes 4 barrels of pure fresh water to make produce 1 barrel of very dirty bituminous oil. And that's not even counting the natural gas that it takes to make it liquid to flow out of the depth. These are industries. These are pursuits. Tar sands. And the fracking that have such a low energy return. I mean, there's so much energy put in, we're getting a very low return. It is time to transition off oil. And the good news is that there's a lot of communities, there's over 200 transition towns now in the United States alone that are rising to meet the challenge of this peak oil and climate crisis. There are things like the Mayor's Accord on the Kyoto Protocol, filled by the Seattle mayor, who said, you know, if they're not going to take international action on this, we can at least take domestic action at the mayor level to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions. And he's got over 1,000 communities signed on to do voluntary greenhouse gas emissions. So this is why it's important to lend our voices now to what's going on the streets, whether it's a march to stop the tar sands, to join with our brothers and sisters in the corridor from Alberta down to Texas and all the states in between, Nebraska, Idaho, Montana, and just say, no, this insanity is, it's too costly for us. We don't need what I call debt jobs. the jobs that, okay, they make a job making a pipeline, but guess what? You're displacing farmers who have been, and ranchers who have been on these lands for four and five generations. That is not a job creation on the plus side, okay? We have to start attaching our values to these jobs, and we say, when it costs too much for the environment, when it costs too much. I mean, there's displaced fishermen in Cordova, Alaska. There's this, just last week, Dean Blanchard, the primary shrimp buyer, wholesale buyer in all of Louisiana, went out of business. It is not enough to say, look at all these jobs offshore in the industry. It was time to start saying, at what expense are those jobs coming?
Exactly.
At whose cost?
Right. You see, and that's exactly the point, Ricky. It's like, unless there is an actual specific assessment, just tossing, if you hear the word jobs or energy tossed around, then you're really hearing a PR statement that someone has paid for. Because unless you do the tally sheet the way you are doing and say this job in this industry versus this job in this industry versus our water, this industry versus our food versus our health versus our tourism versus our fisheries, whatever it is, unless there's a really careful assessment, and governments are strapped nowadays, and it's hard to get those passed, and agencies have been stripped, and these assessments aren't being done. So just to hear that the word jobs is being tossed around isn't telling you a lot, and you shouldn't buy into it. And further, if you hear the word energy tossed around, what you're describing is really, you know, the phrase would be, you know, going to the bottom of the barrel, and that's where
right.
all the gunk resides. And, you know, we don't have to go down there, because I've heard many, many presentations that were at renewables. In terms of, you know, kind of taking action, Ricky, I want to make sure, because we're kind of coming into the last 5-10 minutes of our show, I want to make sure that our listeners really know, it's actually 5 minutes, really know how they can connect with you, your work, and with some of the initiatives that you've mentioned throughout the course of the show. And one way, of course, is to go to your website, which is rickiott.com, and that's spelled R-I-K-I-O-T-T.com. I'm also wondering whether people can probably be going soon or now to ultimatecivics.org.
Let me throw in a couple other things here, because rickiott.com is sort of where I'm at lecture tour and that kind of thing. I did put a Gulf information on it because I didn't have another really website for that. But we're slowly shifting the oil work over to changingtheendgame.org. And Ultimate Civics is a website for learning about the democracy crisis that we face, because what I'm seeing in America is that the sustainability, how we get to a sustainable future, how we make the planet livable for our children and our grandchildren, let alone future generations, but our immediate children. This is a problem of taking back our control of our food, our water, our energy, our economy at a very local and regional level. And those solutions are being engineered and come up by communities, but they're also being thwarted by the problem that we have these corporate persons running around claiming that our democratically enacted laws are costing them future profits. So I see sustainability and democracy entwined. So their Ultimate Civics, you can learn about the evolution of corporate personhood, the demise of our democracy. And there is another website, movetoamend.org. That is a national grassroots coalition that I helped co-found that is moving state by state. It has affiliates. It has chapters to, in fact, amend the Constitution. And just, in fact, yesterday, Boulder, Colorado just got it on its ballot for abolishing corporate personhood in the jurisdiction of Boulder, Colorado. This could be happening, is happening, in other communities in other states. So
well, that's really terrific news. Move to amend. We're going to have to close out our program here. So movetoamend.org, and it's really been a complete delight once again to talk to you, Ricky Ott. And I urge listeners to read your two books, to look forward to your coming book, to go to these websites and take action. We'll have you on the show again. Thank you so much for being with us on Connect the Dots today.
Very delighted to be part of your show. And please, listeners, do go to changingtheendgame.org because you'll see the real golf story is posted there as a one-hour show that I did in back in April to help
That's
people
terrific.
Realize that our government's lying to
thank
us.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you so much for all your work, Ricky. And listeners, thank you for being with us here on Connect the Dots. Tune in next week.